Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Now we've got, you know, the room is crowded. You know, I can't get enough attention here. So we've got Mr. Michael Hawley.
Hi, Al. just in case they talk about Jack the Ripper, I'm here. I'm here for you.
Yeah, he's a Jack the Ripper man. He likes ripping Jack off. And we've got the famous baseball icon, Dave Martino.
Now I'm a baseball icon.
Yeah, well, you're the baseball icon. You decided that last show. I mean, you know, I mean, hey.
That guy isn't even a pro ball player.
Well, I know, but it doesn't matter. This is the days of internet, and we can be what we want to be.
Dave Martino is now like the new John Smith.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, throwing the balls. So, you know, we will jump right into it today because we've got a man all the way from across the world talking to us today. And he's got a new book. The book is called China Hand. And this is Scott Spacek. So thank you for being here, Scott.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wow. So this is quite a story, the book and everything. But before we get into the story, maybe talk a little bit about how you came to writing this story.
Sure. So the answer is pretty simple. I mean, over the years living in China, I just saw, experienced, and heard about so many things I thought could be really great ingredients for a realistic, you know, torn from the headlines espionage story, and I wanted to write one. There's really been so many, you know, great espionage novels involving Russia or the Middle East, but very, very few set in China or Asia more broadly. And it just seemed like the perfect time with, you know, China, the top potential rival to the U.S. right now, and a Chinese government determined to displace us economically, diplomatically, militarily. The FBI is opening a new China-related, you know, counterintelligence case every 12 hours. So I just thought reader demand was there, and I'd had the background for a great story.
You know, it's interesting now. China, it can be quite controversial in North America. Like, you know, people have a lot of, both Canada and the U.S. have strong opinions, and it's been in the news a lot about the different issues going on. Does that ever worry you a little bit when you are writing about something from that part of the world?
Well, there's two things I was worried about. You know, one is I was conscious that relative to a story set, especially in Europe, Americans have generally less background about China. So you'd have to kind of explain, you know, the setting a lot more than you would, you know, for another story. So I didn't want to be kind of academic about the book, but I did feel like if I wrote something, I'd have to kind of explain the background in more detail, because otherwise people might assume in some ways it's like, either they might assume it's like the U.S. in some ways, or they might kind of exoticize it in how they envisioned it. So one is just the kind of education that might be needed. The other, exactly as you said, I didn't want to demonize the place. So, you know, hopefully as readers read it, they'll see that I really, you know, I've spent roughly 20 years in China, and it's really a wonderful place, you know, in many ways. And having spent so much of my time there and studying the language and really falling in love with the people and culture, I really didn't want to create a caricature of the country. So exactly as you said, I think there's this risk of as the Chinese government does become a major rival and there's a lot of challenges, how do you talk about that honestly without kind of, you know, writing a caricature or demonizing the place?
Yeah, and there's quite a there's like, I almost call it a cultural barrier, right? Because it must be hard coming from a different culture where it's obvious and try to get past that barrier. And I mean that as in where they actually start to be real with you as a people, as a culture, like they start to accept you as part of themselves. Would you say that's fair?
I mean, of course it's fair, and part of it's cultural and part of it's just, you know, I often say linguistic. You know, and I work professionally, obviously, in China as well. And many people ask me, they say, hey, you know, how people might say, hey, I find it difficult to work, you know, with Chinese for this reason or that. And I say, look, like in their defense, could you imagine if somebody came to the U.S. and didn't speak English, right? How would you, as a native born American person who only spoke English, you treat or kind of work with that person? Well, of course, it'd be a little awkward or a little bit difficult to break that barrier. And I think for them, it's the same with people who don't speak Chinese. There's that cultural barrier, you could say, but a lot of it's just frankly linguistic, because I found, you know, I do speak Mandarin, and I have certainly found that overall the people actually are quite direct, quite outgoing, quite funny, quite normal in every respect, especially once you can get through that language barrier.
Is that what you would call the biggest, let's say, the biggest thing that, let's say, Americans get wrong about China, like it's kind of the culture?
I do. I mean, it's, you know, I joke, and I don't want to stereotype too much, but I know that growing up as I did in the U.S. and whether I had, you know, Chinese, there were other Chinese students I studied with or teachers or colleagues or whatever, there is that stereotype that, you know, people will say Asians are quiet. Well, if anything, I find Chinese as a culture, and again, I'm just stereotyping broadly, are actually quite direct and outgoing, and in many ways, you'd say quite American. But of course, you know, you could imagine for people, especially who've moved to the U.S. That don't speak the language natively. And I know I struggle with this not being a native Chinese speaker when I've had to work in Chinese. I mean, it's very difficult to come across as your genuine normal self when you're speaking in a foreign language, and I do think that's a huge element, right?
Yeah. What is the biggest thing we get wrong about China in the States?
I do think that there's this tendency, I don't know if I'm exactly answering your question, but when people in America tend to talk about China, they tend to come from one of two angles, each of which I find is wrong. You know, one angle is that there is this people exoticize China and think that to understand it, you have to speak with these mysterious China hands. It's a little bit of a joke, obviously, with the book title, but, you know, long time, people who lived in China for a long time, who love the country, and they can kind of translate this mysterious culture because it's so foreign and so different. And then when you speak with those, you know, so-called China hands, often maybe they are kind of in love with China and generally view China through rose-tinted glasses as well. So there's this mistake one, I think, is to exoticize the place and not ascribe kind of normal incentives and normal motivations to China or Chinese people. At the flip side, which also is kind of exoticizing it or treating it as an other, is to just demonize it and describe, you know, ulterior motives or whatnot. I mean, in my view, and this has been my experience working there professionally, negotiating contracts. It's also been my observation with, you know, with U.S.-China relations more broadly. The best thing to do with China is to treat it as a normal country driven by normal motivations. And I always joke, you know, Chinese people, I think people in general, tend to be motivated ultimately by the same things. I mean, historically, people want, you know, they want money, they want power, they want relationships, they want sex. I mean, there's just so many normal things people want, and then they pursue them in some way. And I broadly think that the best way to think about China or Chinese people is to think of them very normally and assume that they're going after normal things. And in China's case as a country, you know, of course, they've grown a lot economically. It's remarkable just how much bigger, how much wealthier China is than when I first went there 25 years or so ago. And of course, China wants to kind of throw its weight around globally. I think that's very normal and not very strange. It doesn't make them evil. It just means they're trying to play a bigger role in the world and maybe be, frankly, the top dog.
Well, is language the biggest barrier to those who can't speak Chinese living in China, or is it something else?
I think so. You know, it's not, I don't know if either one of you's, you know, been there, but it's not, I find anymore such a difficult place to be there. I say anymore because when I first went there, the per capita income in China was, you know, under $1,000. I mean, the people in general were downright poor. Even the relatively wealthy in Beijing or Shanghai, you know, the hygiene standards, the infrastructure, it was a poor developing country. I mean, when I first went, I made $250 a month in China was my salary. And so back then you could say, well, you know, a real challenge was, you know, you couldn't get around. It was hard to get online. It was hard to make phone calls. It was hard to, you know, you'd get food poisoning on a certainly weekly basis, often every few days. I mean, it was definitely a challenge, you know, a hardship posting, as they used to say. I think today it's, you know, I think it's still not as wealthy as the U.S. by any standards, but it's a different country, but it's to me not fundamentally different. Living day to day, I'll say it's not fundamentally different from living, let's say, in a very foreign European country. You know, that said, clearly, you know, I left in 2020, you know, soon after COVID had started. I should say that in addition to language, something that does kind of, I'll say, wear on you. I mean, clearly there is a lot of surveillance. Clearly things are being monitored. Clearly it gets frustrating when you see sometimes the way things are reported in the news, you know, the manipulation of things. Like clearly that, it doesn't affect, I'll say, your day-to-day like living standards. It's not difficult because it's difficult to get something to eat or, you know, live your kind of life day to day. But clearly, I think emotionally, especially as an American who grew up elsewhere, the control of information, the authoritarianism that you do see, I mean, that does, I'll say, wear on you. It doesn't typically impact you day to day until maybe it does, as you've seen some Americans get in trouble. But I don't know if that answers the question. I know it's a little rambling.
Yeah. So let's talk about the premise of the book. What's the basic idea in this book or the basic story?
Well, the basic story, and then I'll get into maybe how I decided to write it or came up with the plot. Basic story is this kind of coming of age adventure story meets spy novel. So the background is, you know, a new university grad gets an offer to teach at a Chinese university, and he just goes off. You know, he studied a little bit of Chinese and he goes to China looking for adventure and to perfect his Chinese. He ends up teaching at an elite Chinese university where they happen to teach diplomats and, you know, frankly, spies. But, you know, midway through his time there, the CIA approaches and just, he says his beautiful colleague and love interest is the daughter of a top general who's on the verge of defecting, and they need his help to get her out. So it's supposed to be this simple mission, this simple operation. But of course, nothing goes according to plan, and it ends up being a, you know, a chase for his life, a run for his life, you know, with the full power of the Chinese state after him. That's kind of the quick background. I used to say, for people old enough to remember some of these books, I used to say it's between genres. It's a little bit a book called River Town, which was a nonfiction book by Peter Hessler about, you know, going to teach in China and experiencing it. It's a little bit of River Town, you know, guy teaches English in China, meets The Firm, he doesn't realize what he's signed up for, you know, meets the Bourne identity. He's kind of transformed into a super spy. That's kind of the background. How did I write it? Well, you know, teaching back when I did at the school and then living for many years, I just frankly saw, you know, a number of things that I thought could be, or I heard about things that could be the basis for a great novel, whether it's the surveillance and authoritarianism I mentioned, whether it's going to kind of diplomatic or consulate related parties and obvious, you know, seeing people that were obviously intelligence officers or whatnot, trying to kind of buddy up to people, or being, you know, frankly, you know, as many Americans living in China have been, you know, detained by the police at some point, just some kind of adventurous things that I thought could be great elements of the story. But then the real plot idea came from in December 2000, a top Chinese colonel named Xu Jinping defected while with a military delegation in the U.S. And it just got me thinking, you know, I guess it was easy for him to defect. He often traveled to the U.S. for work. He could just basically, you know, leave. He could just basically defect while in the U.S. But did he have a family? How did they get out? Who might have been involved in helping them? And I realized, or I knew about a story where a Princeton professor after Tiananmen Square had been involved helping a Chinese dissident to actually flee. You know, even though he was sort of under house arrest, you know, professor helped this guy flee to the U.S. consulate or embassy in Beijing and eventually, you know, get out. And I just started thinking, okay, what if there's this top PLA official like Xi Jinping in 2000 who needed to defect, but, you know, to get his family out, you know, they need somebody's help who's living there. It just happens to be a random American who's just doing something normal like teaching or studying or working. And then everything kind of went from there. So that was the concept. And I guess for readers today, it's a little bit like Tokyo Vice in the sense, except in Beijing and with PLA instead of the Yakuza, in the sense that it's kind of an adventure story living in China. And then this American kind of gets caught up, you know, in a crazy kind of espionage story.
How is it you create your characters for something like this? Because it sounds like there's a lot of reality, and then there's a, you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of reality, but there's also fiction in that. So do you draw from real people to create the characters, or is this just totally your own?
Well, it's clearly a mix of both. So as you know, as I tried to say, like the plot overall is heavily drawn from a whole series of real events. So I mentioned the inspiration of the Chinese colonel defecting. You know, I mentioned the inspiration of this Princeton professor who was involved. There were a bunch of other things as well. So clearly the true elements are, you know, there's also the U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. There's Bo Xilai and the new leftist movement and a CIA officer who kind of a turncoat U.S. former CIA officer named Jerry Chunsing Lee, who is believed to expose much of the network. So much of the plot is kind of inspired by, I say, real events. And then the characters, again, it's a bit of a mix. So for better or for worse, I will say, especially 25 years ago, relatively few people went to China. So I joke that there were a lot of real characters there. So, you know, kind of the old, you know, you joke, the old China hands who'd been there since the, you know, since the 70s or early 80s, kind of very interesting characters like the, you could say the Tom Blum character that's in the book, or other just fairly random Americans, maybe like myself, but also, you know, the character Will is a little bit inspired by a former military guy that I taught with at the school. And clearly in Andrew's case, he's inspired by, you could say, elements in my own life, but it's definitely not me. I mean, what I sometimes say is, in the same way that, you know, Jack Carr has drawn on real elements from his own experience as a Navy SEAL to create James Reese. Well, I've tried to do the same with Chinahan, but clearly, you know, Andrew Callahan is not me, and none of the characters are directly real people.
Well, you are clearly Lily.
Exactly. Actually, my wife is kind of suspicious of who this mysterious Lily might be, but yeah, it's definitely not me.
Well, how do you experience your characters? Do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear the dialogue in your head, or is it more that you visualize the story as you're putting everything into prose?
Well, the real challenge, the real thing, you know, I'm a first time writer. I've never, you know, I never took a writing class. I never, this is really the first thing I've ever written. And the real danger for me on that question of how realistic is it is you do default sometimes to writing, especially this book is in the first person, obviously. When you're writing in the first person, writing something that starts to come across like too much of a memoir or too autobiographical, and you do, at least I found, I defaulted to almost having Andrew come across like me, even when I tried to fictionalize him. I was afraid that's how he came across. And as a result, I think, and you know, the first and second drafts, I think, came in at like 450 pages. And I think the biggest change, frankly, between those early drafts and the final was just slashing stuff that was too close to me and making sure that I was really creating a character as opposed to, recounting personal events. So that's, as a first-time writer, I do think I default to things a little bit closer to my own experience, but that's probably natural.
Scott, how about Hong Kong? Do you get Hong Kong involved? Because I had been there before the time when they became part of China, but that's very lots of English speaking was going on there.
You know, in an earlier draft, because I've spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. I traveled there back when I was teaching, and then I did live there at one point for a few years. I did try to bake it in because I was trying, you know, so many kind of fun international adventure stories do kind of jump from city to city and so on. In an earlier draft, there was a key scene in Hong Kong. I removed it all because I just found it a little bit difficult to bake into this story. But, wait for the sequel and it will show up there.
So at the end of the day, someone picks up the book and they take it home, read it. Is there something that you want them to take away from the book? Is there a subtext or something other than the entertainment and the story itself?
The only real subtext, I mean, I do hope that readers go away. And look, clearly the book is dramatized. Clearly it's fictionalized. Clearly, and I'm a little, I shouldn't say embarrassed, but clearly there are elements that are a little over the top. I mean, as in any adventure story, but I really hope that, readers, especially ones who maybe haven't been to China or Asia in general, I mean, hopefully they learn something. Hopefully they feel like they've a little bit gotten to experience, a culture they didn't know better, didn't know very well. And hopefully they feel like they understand it, just a little bit better. And then hopefully, because of some of the plot elements about, of course, China's trying to, I think, usurp the U.S. as a great power. Hopefully people start to take China a bit more seriously. I mean, I'm always astonished, and this is one of the, backgrounds to the book. Like I said, there's so many stories focused on Russia, for example, as a threat to the U.S., as a rival. People have grown up with the Cold War and so on. And I do think that's a big driver of why, even though, at least in my view, the only existential threat to the U.S., the only country that could possibly surpass the U.S. in our lifetimes is China. It's the only true near peer or soon to be peer military and economic rival. And yet, it's astonishing to me that the headlines overwhelmingly just focus on Russia and the Middle East, and our diplomatic corps continues to focus on Russia and the Middle East. I really hope people start to take China a bit more seriously as a major power, as a rival. And I think that would be a good outcome.
Oh, so why do you think everyone just sort of doesn't take China so seriously? Why they're put Russia? I sort of think that Russia tends to be more aggressive, like in their moves, especially like what they're doing now and before in Croatia and stuff. If Russia wants to do something, they'll just go do it. Type thing, and it doesn't surprise me. But what do you think is the reason that in general people don't take China so serious?
I think there's two or three reasons. I mean, one is people don't have the background, and look, just a generation ago, China was pretty poor. So this wasn't a challenge I think that we had 25 years ago, right? So I think one is people didn't grow up with this challenge. They didn't kind of study it in school. The diplomatic corps didn't grow up, taught to treat China necessarily as a rival. So I think there's a bit of background is kind of one. I do think there's a second element, which is, I think China as a country has very intentionally for many years, I mean, Deng Xiaoping had the adage, I'll get it slightly wrong, it was something like, you know, bide your time and hide your brilliance. This idea of China, while it's relatively weak, should go out of its way to come across as non-threatening and not get the U.S. to focus on it. And then building on that, you know, there's clearly a massive, lobbying and influence effort by China and by, I'll say, friends of China to not treat China as a rival. So I do think, and I talk a little bit, I hint about this in the book, even though it's set years ago, I do think China has truly infiltrated, I mean, U.S. academia, U.S. corporates. They actively, you know, push U.S. corporates to lobby on China's behalf. Don't let the U.S., you know, if you don't help us get the U.S. government not to push back on something or not to treat us like, you know, if you don't lobby on our behalf, you know, we won't let you into China. We won't let you do business here. And I do think that universities, academics, the Chinese government, many, many people lobbying on China's behalf have kind of kept it out of the focus. I mean, you do see even in books and media, it's interesting trying to get a China. I've heard this from many people. If you try to make a movie focused on China as a rival, it gets killed because they know that China will punish the publishing company, the movie house. I mean, obviously people saw this with Top Gun.
Yes.
People were all worried. Look, if you even show this patch, the movie house will never be able to show another movie in China. You see the same. I heard the same with books, with writing my own book. It was definitely an issue getting it published. I heard it from very well-known authors, and I can't disclose who they are, who've proposed sequels or even had a best-selling China-related book. And, you know, people said, look, we just can't make this into a movie because, you know, we're not allowed to touch on China. And I do think the cumulative effect of all these things is the average person never hears about China's arrival. And so they just think it's not an issue, you know, until I think one day it will wake up and be a major issue. And I think that time is now.
I think the FBI Director Wray recently made a comment that he was stunned by how much espionage has been going on with China when he came into his position.
Oh, look, absolutely. And I mean, even to personalize it or give it a true anecdote, I mean, I used to work with a lot of U.S. educated Chinese engineers, and I remember one of them half joking but half seriously saying that basically everybody he knew that studied it or worked in the U.S. in a technical area at some point either was contacted or knew of a close acquaintance that was contacted by the local Chinese consulate to hand over some sort of information or technology or whatnot they had access to. China is well known for, you know, they manage actively, you know, the there's these so-called Chinese students and scholars associations. It's basically like the Chinese Student Association at every major U.S. university. These are part of the so-called United Front. They are actively managed by the Chinese consulates. The Chinese consulates monitor the activity of Chinese students in the U.S., and they actively push them.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And to help where needed or help where wanted, you know, in the U.S. with information, intelligence, et cetera, it is truly, as I think Ray has said, like on China's part, a whole of society effort to steal information and gain leverage over the U.S. And I do think people need to wake up to, you know, it's not that China's an evil place. I just think they're leveraging every asset they have in a very systematic way. And the U.S., I think, has been very naive about this threat.
I agree. And also, I think what's been happening the last few years, and this is where Russia is involved too, is the United States seems to be an experiment for authoritarians to see how much they can get, the United States can get controlled by fake news, the whole system. They're watching very closely.
Oh, look, and it's not, and to be clear, I agree with you entirely, and Russia has been a real problem there. And let there be no doubt that China does exactly the same things. And I think, you know, with TikTok, I am, look, two examples. One, we're doing this meeting on Zoom. You know, Zoom's back end is entirely in China. I have no doubt this call is monitored in China. You know, the vast majority of the Zoom engineering team is in Shanghai. I have no doubt that they leverage this, right? Likewise, TikTok, no doubt whatsoever, as they've even admitted finally a month or so ago again, everything that goes, every morsel of information that goes into TikTok runs through Beijing and is being analyzed and monitored and leveraged in some influence campaign, you know, by China, either today or in the future, by Chinese intelligence. Let there be no doubt, right? And I think it is astonishing to me, as much as we've talked about so-called fake news and Russian disinformation, which is a real threat, to be clear, China is either doing or looking to do the same things, and they're looking to leverage platforms like Zoom and TikTok, which all run through China.
And House of Mystery, they're leveraging everything. I can see it.
Absolutely. And look, the U.S. does as well, you know, like, as they will point out, you know, China has found flaws in Cisco routers and all sorts of things like this. And they'll say, hey, the U.S. does the same thing. And I'm not denying that. So back to my point about, you know, let's treat China as a normal country. Well, let's do so. But in that way, let's be eyes wide open about maybe the vulnerabilities we're creating, you know, by doing different things. And in some cases, we may say, hey, you know, it's fine to import, I'm making it up, to import toys or consumer goods or some things. But you might say, hey, do we want Do we want to have our social media or telecommunications running through China? You know, as you might have seen in the news just this week, there was a story, a report, I think, by CNN, where they said, you know, there's a belief that potentially, you know, Huawei cell towers near missile bases in the Middle East, in the Midwest, were able to block the potential launch or communications with, you know, with nuclear weapons in Wyoming or something, right?
Yes, and yes.
Let's just be eyes wide open about the vulnerabilities we're creating, and some we can accept and some we probably can't. In the same way, by the way, I say China effectively blocks all these areas that I'm talking about. So, you know, they've long ago, roughly in 2008, they kicked out all the Western, you know, internet companies. They certainly are trying to block or rip out U.S. technology across their economy. So I often say it's not about demonizing China. I say let's just treat China as a peer, as an equal, and let's look for some symmetrical relationship. And if they block our goods, you know, let's not do it in a kind of over the top nonsensical way. But you know what? Like, there are probably areas where they've blocked some things from our side, and maybe we should just treat them equally, and maybe we can then jointly agree to lower barriers. But until they lower some on U.S. Technology or products, maybe we should raise some on our side.
Right.
Well, yeah. And when you were putting the story together, when you were involved somewhat, and you do any sort of research, or you're doing any sort of, you know, work on this story, or were you worried about being watched?
Well, I have no doubt. I mean, it's funny, when the Cold War ended, all these people who'd lived in Russia or Eastern Europe, they discovered that there were these files on, you know, on them. These might have been very normal people who just happened to visit Russia or USSR at the time. I have no doubt there are files on me. I have no idea. I have no doubt that a little bit, as Andrew in the book discovers, you know, a bug. I have no doubt there was surveillance equipment, and there's various files on me. And certainly, you know, without going into too much detail, I mean, there were incidents where it fairly innocuous. I was at a Harvard alumni event in roughly 2008, 2009. And I still don't exactly know what was going on. It was a relatively small event in Shanghai, and at least 20 police kind of came in, lined us all up, took all our photos with, you know, high resolution cameras from multiple angles. And I don't know if this was an early attempt to kind of capture our faces in a way that they somehow didn't when you entered the country, because obviously they take your picture when you go in. I don't know why they did this, but it was one of the odder things. But I'm sure that showed up in some file. And of course, yeah, of course we're monitored. And I tried to, you know, bake that into the book as well.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of strange. And I think that it's kind of scary in a way. Just this whole knowing about all this stuff and being sort of somewhat in involved in it. Does that sort of put you on edge a little?
Well, sometimes I do wonder if it's made me paranoid. I mean, paranoid is a bit extreme, obviously, but it has definitely opened my eyes to things that the average person, you know, wouldn't think about. I mean, you asked, what are the challenges living in China? Clearly, and I've spoken with a bunch of reporters about this. Certainly every reporter I know at some point has been arrested or detained. And many people I know who've, like myself, who lived in China for years, especially, you know, years ago, at some point we were, as one example, I was talking to a reporter about this at an anniversary, at a Tiananmen Square anniversary. We happened to be walking through Tiananmen Square on June 4th of some year. And there was a protest. Some people unfurled a banner, and, you know, we got kind of tackled and thrown in a van and held for, you know, several hours, being asked, you know, were we affiliated with that protest? What were we doing right there? That was not a coincidence, of course. You know, confess that somehow we helped orchestrate it and we're with the CIA. And that went on for several, you know, uncomfortable hours. And clearly there's surveillance. Clearly, you know, people have hinted at knowing things that could compromise us. Clearly that they've, and I've read, I was reading a story about this just a couple days ago, I think with regards to the Fed. Yeah, there was a story about the Fed a couple days ago, I think in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, where it's alleged now that China has a network working within the Federal Reserve, and they've been using that to, you know, try to get information about rate changes and maybe influence things. And clearly, in the case of one person they were trying to leverage, they basically said, look, you know, we have dirt on you. We've been monitoring your calls, you know, either help us, or we will, reveal this. So just traditional blackmail, no doubt with, you know, what they know from Zoom and monitoring. It's well known, you know, they will tap probably everybody who goes to China. Your cell phone, it gets penetrated. It, you know, some type of malware gets put on it. Clearly, if you use WeChat, there's some kind of malware that monitors your microphone and probably camera. Clearly, they will use that for blackmail in key situations. I have no doubt.
Yeah, we call that compromise. Us Russian agents.
it's exactly the same thing. And there's, you know, well-known in espionage books is the story of, you know, honey traps and so on. And China is also well-known for leveraging that, just as Russia does. So all these things, it's not that China's evil or totally different, but let there be no doubt, they play hardball with the best of them.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and I don't think people necessarily dislike China more than, let's say, Russia or anything else. But isn't it more about the way they treat their own people? Because isn't that kind of the idea in America is that China is still very bad to its people, and there's not a lot of freedom. Do you think people would treat them as a more serious threat, let's say, if they were a freer country? Because in a sense that if they had more of a country that run more like the U.S.
I don't know. I do think that maybe the reason one reason, even people who go there don't always see it as a threat, is I should be clear. You know, when you go, the people, again, speaking in with broad strokes and stereotypes, the people are very warm. Typically, if you visit for a business trip or you visit as a tourist, you'll have a wonderful experience. People will be very nice. The average person is very friendly. And you'll go away with this. And by the way, you typically, it's funny, I got a negative book review from somebody who basically commented, they said, look, I visited China 20 years ago and nothing like this happened to me. And I actually interacted with the person saying, oh, great, glad you went there. Glad you had a good time. And I sort of got to know him a little bit better. And he basically said he went for 5 days in 1998 or something and had a great time. And he didn't see any surveillance, therefore it couldn't be happening. And I do think that, that sort of personal experience influences things in a major way. And like I said, I also think that there are so many Chinese, a big role too, or issue, I think, is not issue, but influence is there are something like 300,000 Chinese students in the U.S. There are literally millions of Chinese who now work in the U.S. People interact with Chinese people all the time, and they sort of say, hey, China's not so bad. I work with Jack. He's a nice guy. I couldn't believe anything's going on. And by the way, Jack might be perfectly innocent and a perfectly nice guy. It doesn't mean that the Chinese government, you know, maybe as you're hinting by separating the government from the people, it doesn't mean that the Chinese government isn't very calculating and trying to, do things. And by the way, it's also the case, back to why the Chinese people themselves, as you were just hinting, why they say what they do, it's because they all know they're monitored. They have to watch what they say, or they could be in trouble because, you know, it is a very authoritarian country.
You have Japan involved in your book at all?
At the very end. So again, wait for the sequel.
okay. But,
it does end a little bit in Japan. There's a couple Japanese characters, but no, the book itself, you know, a little bit linked to what we've been talking about. It's funny that I wrote it originally. I just assumed I would write a book in the present, but back to where I started and where we started in the discussion about what were the challenges. I found myself trying to educate the readers so much on basic elements of how we got where we are in the U.S.-China relationship and so on, that it was almost easier just to start at the origin and say, okay, the story takes place 25 years ago or 20 years ago, and it's at kind of on the ground floor of kind of China starting to plan these things, maybe trying to get the U.S. distracted in the Middle East for 20 years so they can break out, maybe trying to plant these agents in the U.S. or leverage companies or leverage students or get compromise, as you said, on people. So this story takes place 20 years ago, and it's a bit of an origin story. The sequel will heavily involve Japan, at least if it turns out as I'm currently planning for it to. And there's a little bit of involvement in Japan, but otherwise, I moved here really after I finished the book, and it didn't originally intend for Japan to play a major role.
But I'm sure they are going to be anyway, because they're both financially powerful.
Well, clearly the reason it's involved and the reason there's an obvious linkage is Japan historically has been kind of top dog in Asia, at least in modern times, at least, clearly in the last 100 or so years. And clearly before, China passes the U.S., it will have passed. It already has passed, you could say, Japan. And Japan China definitely has a bit of a vengeful mindset here. Chinese are educated. I talk a lot about this in the book. There is a real patriotic, they call it patriotic education. They drill into students' heads this idea that, Japan is evil and we need to get revenge on Japan. And it is, frankly, they sort of do the same with the U.S., that the U.S. has always tried to hold China down and we need to kind of rise up and pass the U.S. and we'll get our revenge on the U.S. too. Japan feels very threatened. There's a real rivalry. There's a real sense that if there is any conflict, Japan will kind of be at the front lines. So clearly, if you're writing an espionage-related story, it's not difficult to have Japan play a role there.
Ah, wow. So did you have a sequel plan, like in your mind before you were finished this book and doing a sequel, an idea? Do you sort of outline all this ahead of time and kind of know where you're going to go and just telling the story? Is there going to be more than another sequel, or what's kind of your idea?
Well, like I said, the original idea here was, or if not the original, the idea that I had relatively soon was that this would be kind of the origin story of a series of books, I'll say based on or inspired by actual events, because there's so many real espionage-related stories. So obviously, as I said, this one is primarily inspired by the defection of a top Chinese military official. There are other stories, you could say, in my head. In the news every day is an espionage, it's a cyber-related espionage, cyber theft story in the news. And without giving too much away, that's going to be at the core of the sequel I've planned. And similarly, we've already hinted at the role that U.S. corporations play in all this. So China leverages, China leverages access to the China market to influence U.S. universities and academics to push them to basically toe the line with China. So you see it with the NBA, if you speak up about, if even one player tweets about Taiwan, the NBA may be banned from China. So you know what, NBA, you go lobby on our behalf, to get our view out there. Likewise, any major company, you lobby on our behalf, or we will kick you out. Same Google, even though Google is not currently in China, at least domestically in the way they used to be, there's no domestic, Google.com. Google makes a lot of money cross-border, helping Chinese companies advertise in the U.S. You know what, Google? If you don't want us to shift our ad dollars to Facebook, you lobby the U.S. government. Same with banks. That whole role of China twisting the arms of U.S. companies and universities, getting them to effectively, in many ways, be on China's side. I always... going a little bit on tangent here, but I'm always astonished that you had Google and tech companies partnering in many ways on AI with the Chinese military through a universities, but really with the Chinese military, while at the same time, you know, Google in particular, and I think others basically said, look, we will not work with the U.S., you know, certainly ICE or the U.S. military on AI because the U.S. is evil, you know, and they didn't say it explicitly, but they would not work with the U.S. government in some of the same ways that often they were working with the Chinese government. I just think that's absurd, and all these things will show up in the sequel, I'll put it that way.
So it sounds like you're going to bring the series from like 98 and into current times.
Yeah, if you jump to the last page, it sort of gives it away. But I did toy, and I could still go back to this. Originally, my agent and I were talking about kind of stepping forward one step at a time. You could always have these look backs taking place over the last 20 years, like things that were buried and now have come out. But I think just because people often do want a story in the present, and there's so much going on right now, that I think the immediate sequel will take place in current times.
Right. Wow. So now, how do you like people, readers and stuff, to get in contact with you? What is your contact information? Do you have like a website, social media,
so
phone number?
Easiest way, you can find me at scottspacek.com. I've got my author page. You can find me at Twitter at scottspacek as well. Those are probably the two best, the website or at Twitter. And I think if you just search for the book China Hand or China Hand Scott Spacek, you can find a whole bunch of other, whether the Simon & Schuster or Post Hill sites or other reviews from Kirkus and others. So pretty easy to find me.
Yeah, of course, we'll have that linked up on our website and everyone can find you with one click, you know. So on the new one, are you going to involve the pandemic, and are you going to even touch that, or do you ever go there with that?
I haven't yet. I do hint at some conspiracy theories about the pandemic, even in China Hand. There's been a lot of allegations and hints, and at some point, a Chinese official says, well, you know, it wouldn't be so hard for us to do, you know, the bioterrorism or so on. So that a little bit pops up, and the city of Wuhan pops up, you know, very tangentially in China Hand. I haven't explicitly yet put the pandemic into the, I'll say, the core elements of the plot, but I'm also relatively early in writing it. So, you know, you never know, but the sequel is very focused on kind of cyber espionage and China influencing companies and kind of all these parties and the dynamics. So not doing a good job of pitching it, but it's still early days.
Well, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be, I don't know, you have to be very careful when you get into conspiracy too, especially with the pandemic and things like that. I would imagine you not want to get too deep into that.
Well, you have to in general, because again, back to my point about not wanting to demonize China, you've got to do that. And also, to be frank, like, as I said, it is, I'll just say sad, the extent to which maybe influence. I mean, China does a good job. You might have seen in the news, often the Chinese government very openly says that it's racist. It's racist to criticize China. Right. If you criticize the Chinese government, you're just being racist. And I do think they've cleverly leveraged a lot of the kind of, whether it's the culture wars or the kind of cultural dynamics in the U.S. right now, to get their way. And I will say that, you know, whenever you write a book about China, you're a little bit damned if you do, damned if you don't on almost every element, because I kind of find in sharing early drafts with people, I either found I'd share it with a so-called old China hand who'd say, no, this is too hard on China. You're demonizing them. Or somebody'd say, how can you make China look like they'd be spying on the U.S.? You have that group. And then on the other side, you have the kind of, you could say, Fox News or hard, extreme right conservatives who are saying, no, you've got to amp it up more. Like you're downplaying just how evil China is. So it's quite difficult, I'll say, touching on China, because people don't know it well, and many people seem a little dissatisfied, whether it's agents or editors or movie houses. So exactly as you said, it's very tricky. I've tried to thread the needle, but ultimately I leave it up to readers to decide for themselves.
Were you in China when the pandemic hit?
I was actually coincidentally in Hong Kong for that very recent period. So we were in Hong Kong, but I was working a lot. I was working almost every week in China right up until the lockdown. So we knew they were going to lock down. I had been working in Shanghai almost on a weekly basis, but living at the time in Hong Kong, and I was in Hong Kong until late 2020. So they had already, really they locked, tried to get the chronology right. Schools shut roughly, I think it was January 24th of 2020. They were closing the borders. It was either from roughly March 1 of 2020. And things were actually not terrible, on and off in lockdown in Hong Kong in early 2020, but schools were closed. And as I said, in the prep to this, we have two young kids, and we just decided, given the way this seemed to be moving, and we'd been looking at going elsewhere for a while. That's why we left. But yeah, I was very much in Greater China, I'll say, at the beginning of the pandemic, living in Hong Kong and often traveling to mainland China.
Or he was really living in Wuhan. He probably knows a little bit more. We got to talk to him more, Al.
Yeah. Like, what's going on here? So was it a bat or was it a conspiracy? Was it pre-made?
Look, what do I know? But all I will say is I'm back to the point about China leveraging influence. I do think, and I am not a virologist, and so in that regard, I'm just like all of you, but it's a little bit, I think, as John Stewart said, look, there's a level 4, bio research lab at the epicenter of where this breaks out. The speed at which I think China was able to lobby and push, and twist arms of people to say that is absolutely not possible. The speed at which, the WHO and the U.S. basically dismissed the idea that this could have been a lab leak, I think was criminal. I think it's, in many ways, look, I'm a layperson, but it's the obvious reason, it's the obvious cause. I'm not saying that China engineered it. I'm just saying that they, to me, and to basically everyone I know that lived in China, they say, of course, this was a lab leak. But I think this was a clear influence campaign. And they basically twisted the arms of all the U.S. researchers that were doing research in collaboration with China. They twisted the arms of companies. They twisted the arms of media. They very quickly pushed. You had all of U.S. media, and this was a clear influence campaign, also probably aligned with the fact that everybody wanted to demonize anything affiliated with anything that Trump said. Clearly, though, to me, the obvious story was it was somehow a lab leak from that Wuhan lab. But I'm not a virologist, but the speed at which that whole concept was dismissed and criticized as racism or whatnot was truly a remarkable Chinese influence campaign, right up there with anything Russia's ever done.
So coincidentally, the Secret Service lost their emails on January 6th and at that time. Something strange.
Exactly. And in the same way, it would be nice, the same way that the media will jump on any Russian conspiracy, I would encourage them to investigate China conspiracies. And some will be false, but some will be true.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we know Bill Gates created the whole thing, right? Come on. I've had nothing but urges to buy Windows and sell my Mac ever since.
I thought it was Zuckerberg. That's what I heard.
Well, that's true.
Right.
Well, this is great. I really appreciate the conversation. And now the book we're talking about is called China Hand. And our guest is the author, Scott Spacek. So thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now. was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.